Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Yvonne Mason, and the introduction music tonight was brought to you by a really good friend of mine out of Georgia. His name is Dan L. Hollyfield, and the title of that particular song is Indistinguishable from Magic. If you have not yet heard his work, look him up and friend him on Facebook. He creates some of the most spectacular music I have ever heard in my life. I don't know why some of these movie people that do fantasies and sci-fis don't pick him up, because he knows how to write good music. Tonight, we have been joined by another friend of mine, author Glenn Stripling, and with all of the insanity that has been going around, I was supposed to start traveling again this month. It was changed to next month, and it has been canceled. So any of you all who want to come on the show, let me know, and I will set you up. I am so aggravated, I will not be traveling again until August, unless that is put on hold. We'll see what happens here in Florida. Our governor's lost his mind, and most of our mayors have lost their collective minds. So we take one day at a time. But that being said, My guest tonight, author Glenn Strickling, has been on my show before. He is a former petroleum geologist who began writing in 2002. In 2008, he independently published his first novel, and I can never pronounce it, so I'm probably going to massacre it, but it's, all right, Glenn, pronounce it.
Kronoja.
Kronoja, through the publisher Infinity, which is now Fast Pencil. He released his second, The Song of Jupiter, in 2018 via Dressing Your Book, and during the past decade, he has sold stories to Shelter of Daylight, The Martian Wave, Outpost of Beyond, and A Robot, a Cyborg, and a Martian Walk into a Space Bar. Occasionally, he dabbles in Southern literature and has sold stories to Oxford So-and-So. He was also an extra in the motion picture Same Kind of Different as Me, and he lives in Mississippi with his wife, Catherine. He also is in a book called Shelter of Daylight. It is a semi-published digest of upbeat and positive science fiction and fantasy short stories, art, and articles. The works in here appeal to the highest points of readers' imaginations of what is possible and what we dream to be possible. Welcome, Glenn. I'm glad you're back.
Thank you. It's so great to be back. It's so good to hear your sweet voice, and I really think about that first broadcast we did together, and it was so great, and it's good to be here tonight.
Well, thank you. It has been. It feels like it's been forever, but then my shows have been so sporadic, and for a time, you know, I didn't even hold them after we lost Jack, so it's good to be back on the radio and to be doing something other than losing my mind over the insanity that is now out there that I sarcastically call life, because it's not life. I'm not sure what it is. I think it's just an existence. Maybe it's survival. Who knows? So tell me, what have you been up to?
Writing, you know, we've had our, you know, times and goings in life. You know, our dog passed away, some members of my family passed away, and the best way I can deal with it. Yes, I have. In fact, I sent a manuscript about, in February, I should say. It's a story called Animal World. And you may have heard it and heard about it. In Dallas, there's this place called Animal World, where you know, check in and you drive a car around and whatever, and you see the lions and the tigers and whatever. But if your car breaks down, you've got to, you know, stay in your car and they'll come help you, whatever. So I wrote a story about a couple that goes out there, and this lady sees a man that bludgeoned to death her grandmother, and he is now a one of the exhibits at this Animal World Paradise. And, you know, what they did was operate his brain, so he is legally, and the flaws in the future, he is legally not a human being, so, you know, they could do with him what he wants to. And, you know, she recognizes it. I mean, it really freaks her out. And I tried to feel like, you know, just what legally is a human being, what is not a human being, you know. I don't know if you ever heard of The Seas of Titan. It's a, it's one of the stories I sold to The Martian Wave. And that's about a, that's my intake of the, that's my take on the abortion controversy. And that thing, this woman goes to blow up this comet that's headed to this colony, and she tries to save it, and she's confronted by these beings because she had an abortion. and they try to make her feel guilty about it. But some things are just kind of ambiguous. And that's what I try to bring out in some of my stories. You know, sometimes there's not absolutely right, or sometimes there's not absolutely wrong. And, you know.
So let me ask you this. During all of the insanity that has ensued for now we're going on 4 months, do you think at some point in your sci-fi way out there writing career you will incorporate some of the things that have gone on into a story?
Yeah, I probably will. You know, I do a lot of things whimsically, you know, before the pandemic. I used to go to the library, look at things like Discover Magazine, whatever, and find out new science discoveries. I go on the internet and see if the new planets or what have you. And sometimes it would just click an idea into my head. And I thought, okay, maybe I can do some social commentary about it. And then I start, you know, writing. And sometimes I don't even know what I'm going to become up with, but sometimes I come up with something.
Well, if you're like me, you don't know what you're writing until you've written it. And then you go back and you say, oh, did I write that? Because, ladies and gentlemen, we as writers, we sometimes want to write something one way, but the voices in our head sort of take over and we don't realize that we've written what we've written until we go back and read it. Isn't that right, Glenn?
Yeah, it does. One time I was... it was years ago, but I was sitting in my living room one morning, and I was feeling sorry for myself, and you know, this business is going nowhere. Nobody's reading my stuff. Nobody's buying my stories. I don't know what to do. And so I had to push myself to do it. But I just picked up a legal pad and pencil, and I started writing a story. I don't know what's right. And then I came up with a story called The Volcanoes of Io. It's about volcanoes on Io, which is one of the moons of the planet Jupiter. And it has so much gravitational strength, it just squeezes that moon like a sponge, and it causes volcanoes to blow up. And I thought, okay, I based it on the story of a fear. And about this robot that becomes acquainted with Earth's religions, and he learns the concept of fear and what it does to human beings. And I couldn't believe it, but I sold it to Martian Wave.
And in that story, fear. What people don't realize is fear is as real, or can be as real, as the nose on your face.
Mm-hmm.
Fear can kill you. It'll kill you quicker than
yeah.
any pandemic or anything else. Fear will literally. You've heard people say, well, they died from fright. Literally, they died from fright.
Yeah, that's the most literal thing I've heard about. You know, my mother, you know, struggled with heart disease, and it eventually killed her. But she told me one time that she was driving up to this railroad track, and there was a stalled locomotive there, wasn't moving, and she started to cross the track, and this big locomotive blew his horn and just about blasted her out, and it really scared her. And she looked up and saw the engineer just laughing at her. You know, it was just a practical joke, you know. But she was a woman that was having car problems. And some people don't understand that that is not funny in a lot of places.
Mm-mm. It is not, and to deliberately scare people, it should be criminal within itself. let's just take the silliness that's going on right now. If the news media didn't tell us we needed to be afraid, I would venture to say that 99% of us would not be afraid. Because fear is a great motivator to do dumb things.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I really don't watch, you know, the mainline news much these days, whether it's CNN or Fox or what have you. It's not I'm biased to one point of view or another. It's just they have this mindset that if you have two people on the air and one says his position and then this other says his position, and they often interrupt each other and argue and like that, and then the host says, thank you so much for such a lively discussion. And I'm thinking, okay, I didn't really learn anything. I just saw these two people yelling at each other. I mean, they like
you're
to say
right.
There's two sides, but you can say there's two sides to every story. But, you know, sometimes there's 3 or 5 or 17 sides. And some issues you cannot just resolve it completely in just like, you know, a 5-minute argument.
And that is very true. And the beauty that we have in writing is we can have conclusions.
Yes, we can. And my approach is most of the stories I write, you know, I don't say, well, it's going to be absolutely this or absolutely that. You know, I just leave my readers wondering. I just make the point. The question that I leave them with is the point that I usually try to make. Like, is abortion wrong? I don't know. Is abortion right? I don't know. You know, but, you know, this is these are the questions that we have to deal with, you know, before we make this decision. And I think that's the fairest way to put it. Some people think as well, I'm copping out, you know, but I don't care. It's just that
well,
I don't know the...
Well, isn't that true in any book that we read, Glenn, if a writer is a good writer,
yeah,
they leave the reader... And every reader is different. Every reader gets a different perspective out of a book if they read it with an open mind. And every reader may or may not draw their own conclusion. And I would venture to say that no two readers get the same perspective out of a book. Just like if you see a train wreck and you've got 10 witnesses, you're going to get 10 different eyewitness reports because people don't see the same thing. So the way
exactly.
that you write is a great way to write because it gives each reader their own perspective and their own conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yes, like I say, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Yeah, it's just I'm just reiterating what I just said. You know, to me, the object is to leave the reader asking questions. Like, you know, my greatest compliment is when somebody says to me, Glenn, I read your book and it's really got me thinking.
And that's the greatest compliment that any reader can give an author.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm going to switch gears just a little bit because I was reading the stuff you sent me. And
okay.
Some things popped out at me. One, And I mentioned this in the bio, you were actually a movie extra on a movie. How did that come about, and did it wind up on the cutting room floor, or are you seen in the movie?
Well, you know, like the first movie I was in, the same kind of different as me. You're not really able to see me. I was just too far away from, you know, what the cameras they were shooting at. You know, I couldn't even tell what that black man was saying at the podium because the way they recorded it was that He spoke into a microphone, but it wasn't the microphone at the church over the intercom. It was the microphone of the recording equipment they were making for the movie. So I didn't hear what he said until after my wife and I went to see it. The second movie I was in is called Texas Red. That is being made by a guy named Travis Bills. And last year he stated his goal into making 12 Westerns in 12 months. He wanted to make a movie, a cowboy and Indian movie, out of each one of the months of 2020. But then the COVID thing hit. And so, you know, that messed everything up. But, you know, earlier, you know, that year I drove down to Brookhaven, which I guess is maybe like 100 miles from my house. And we filmed that at a railroad museum in Brookhaven, Mississippi. You know, there was just like this 180,000-pound steam train. But they filmed a stunt scene, okay? Now, my idea of a stunt scene is when, you know, a car flips over, a building blows up or something spectacular, and it takes a professional guy to not get himself killed, whatever. But this stunt scene was a guy climbing down the ladder of a boxcar. And I guess for insurance companies or whatever, you know, that's considered a dangerous scene or what have you. But, you know, I said, okay. And I wasn't even too sure I was going to be the movie, but I drove down there. And I was wearing this, it said that the 1940s, which in some parts of Mississippi, it was still cowboy and Indian taste back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so this lady walked up to me and she says, here, put this on. She gave me this hat, like, you know, a little fedora kind of thing. Not quite like Indiana Jones, but she told me to put it on my head. I says, okay, well, I'm going to be in the picture. And I met this very pretty friendly actress. Her name was Esther Perkins. And we got to talking, and they decided to put us on the scene together where this guy was climbing down from the railroad car. And we were supposed to be, you know, talking with each other like the train passengers, and then they told us to, you know, walk away, you know, the end of the scene. Well, they told us to stand. They had a real cowboy there with, you know, a real horse. I had fun giving him grass, whatever, so he, you know, chewed everything. And he was supposed to ride by. And he left some real horse poop on the train platform. And they told us to stand right next to this horse poop. That was our position that we were supposed to take. You know, she was supposed to stand on one side of it, and I was supposed to stand on the other side. And we were acting like we're talking. And, you know, they shot one scene. They weren't happy with it. So they decided to try it again. So I walked up to her, and I tried to stand about 2 feet away from this nasty stuff. And she said, no, Glenn, we are talking. You're supposed to stand right there. So I walked up just with this awful stuff, you know, just about an inch, you know, away from my toes. And so we shot the scene about one or two times. And then what it was, it had these black women in the group. They were supposed to, you know, it was a whole crowd of people with these black women behind. And when these black women were supposed to pass us, that was our cue to, you know, turn around and walk off. You know, so, you know, it would look in the scene like, you know, people were doing something, like it was just mm-hmm. like a natural effect. So I, with Esther, and, you know, you'll never guess what we were actually talking about.
There's no
she
telling.
Was asking me a she was actually asking me about my a career as a geologist. I was talking to her about geology, but of course they couldn't, you know, pick that up with their microphones and what have you. And I just kind of looking at the side of, my peripheral vision. And for the moment, those black ladies were supposed to pass me. And that would be our cue to, to walk off. And I looked over my shoulder, and they weren't there yet. And then I just slapped my hand on my head. I says, "More I gooped up is same." And she said, "Don't worry about it, Glenn. We'll shoot it again. They're going to shoot it again. They're probably going to shoot it again." And I said, okay. She said, "I'll just tell you when it's time for you to turn around and go." But guess what? They didn't. That was the last scene that they. That was the last take they did. So I'm praying that that won't be the take that's in the movie. It might be. I don't know yet. But Texas Red is about a African American outlaw in Mississippi in the 1840s, and they were trying to track him down. Mr. Mills is just, it's really obsessed with, making movies about real historical figures, mm-hmm. That are fascinating. One he is making was it's about a movie about the last person to rob a stagecoach, and that person happened to be a woman, and he's fascinated with her. Yeah, it was. I knew about it. Paul Harvey did a story about it years ago, but I didn't know too much about her. But he's fascinated with her. Vernon Benton and I drove down to Vicksburg to audition for one of his movies. I think this particular one was about a movie he's making about the Mason gang. The Masons were like the Charles Manson family of the 18th century. In Mississippi, we have this thing called the Natchez Trace. It goes mm-hmm. all the way from Tennessee all the way down to Natchez.
Right.
And there was this maniac who liked to rob and scare people, and he would chop off people's arms and hang them from trees and put skulls on just to terrify everybody. And, he was just a bloodthirsty maniac. But Mr. Mills made a movie about him. I auditioned for it. And Vernon was having a truck trouble that night, so I went down to Star, Mississippi to pick him up at 4 in the morning. We drove to Vicksburg, and he and I auditioned for that movie. They weren't too impressed with me, but they really liked Vernon because he was a recording star. He played some songs with them, but they really liked it. I said, okay, Vernon's really made his point. But, of course, he got killed about a month or so later. So, he won't get to be in the movie. So, of course, we're all disappointed about that.
So, let me ask you something. I'm going to switch gears because you brought up something that you and the young lady were discussing on the train platform, and the fact that you were a petroleum geologist.
Okay.
What is that, and how did it filter into your career in real life?
Well, my father was a petroleum geologist. In fact, he was he spent 20 years working for a company called City Service Oil. Most people call that Citgo. And then he became, I guess it was in 77 or so, he became the head of the Jackson chapter of a company called Coquina. And then he and his friends formed a company called Stripling, Gunner, and Horton and went independent. Then he eventually, became really independent. That's when I started working with him, you know, when he died. And at that time, I'm a naive teenager. I just started MILFES, which is what we call a hard rock, a geology course. You know, they their emphasis on rocks and minerals and what have you. It not things like, you know, oil exploration. But I just had this idea of all these $1,000 bills just hanging off of trees, and I was going to get rich like Jed Clampett and what have you. But I didn't realize, you know, how much work and how much politics, you know, that, you know, was there. And this was at a time when oil business was just collapsing in the 1980s, you know, like they were selling office space in Houston, Texas for like 25 cents a square foot, you know, because it was getting that bad back then. Back then, my favorite joke was, how do you spot a Texas oil man in Midland, Texas? And the answer was, you go into a restaurant and say, hey, waiter. But, you know, I stuck with it, you know, and they kicked me out of MILFES when I was about 2 or 3 years, because my grades were so low in math. My grades were just getting too low, and I couldn't handle it. But then I transferred to Belhaven College. It's now called Belhaven University, but in Jackson. And I pulled my grades up to 2.0 by taking this computer course. And this lady there told me, Glenn, you need to switch to computer because that's a thing, teacher. And I says, well, all right. And when I transferred to Southern Miss, I took some computer courses, and I made Dean's List my very first time there, on my very first semester. You know, when I was at MILFES, I thought the word study meant getting drunk and annoy girls. But but then I became a little more mature. I knew how to study for tests. I knew the strategy and how things work. So I started pulling up my grades. But I'm very lousy at things like statistics and mathematics and building computer hardware and circuits and that kind of thing. You know, one of my professors was a guy that built a lunar landing computer for the Apollo, you know, landing. And he told us that there was just one chip they used how to do it. It's called the NAND gate chip. And back then it was like about $3 a piece. Now, at that time, you can go to Radio Shack and buy one for like 35 cents a piece. And you can make all kinds of weird combinations and build any kind of circuit you want. But I just couldn't handle it. You know, I don't have the I'm not good at things like sewing. I'll never be a surgeon and needle and thread kind of thing like that. And I would put my wire here and put this chip here, wire, and I build all these circuits. And a lot of times they wouldn't work once. Even if I did them correctly, they would not work because, you know, wires oxidize and things go wrong and light bulbs burn out and that kind of thing. So I said, look, I cannot handle this business. So I switched back to geology, and I did my field camp in Wyoming and South Dakota, and I graduated. And I did some subsurface mapping for my father. But what that means is we take data from the oil wells that have already been drilled, and we found out the tops of them. And, of course, oil will migrate to the top of a formation. That's what we tried to find out the where the top of formation is, you know, the porosity and the permeability. I do a lot about that stuff because I used to take oil and gas reports from my father when I was a teenager, and I would be so discouraged. He would do all this work, and then we would have a dry hole. And it happened time again, of course, you know, when we finally had a discovery producing well, you know, we would go out and celebrate. That was my life when I was a teenage kid. You know, of course, you know, that was the Jimmy Carter days. And at that time, oil companies were the bad guys. We were the villains that were killing baby ducks and polluting the environment and getting rich while everybody else was getting poor. So, you know, my life was just upside down from everybody else's. That's the world that I grew up in.
So let me fast forward a little bit. I also read that you wrote a story and you sent it off, and it was probably one of the first ones that you wrote, and you were rejected. Now, and I bring that up because I know we probably have some people here that have put their dream out there, whatever that dream is, whether it's writing or music or art or even applying for a job or even trying to get into a relationship, and they throw everything up against the wall and they throw their entire psychic into it and they get rejected. What you did is, once you were rejected, you didn't sit down and take no for an answer, did you?
No. What I found out kind of quickly is part of this part of the fun of this job is you don't have to deal with people too long that act ridiculous. You know, during my days, I worked at a pizza restaurant, you know, and always wondering how people just getting on my case, like, how long, why do you take so long to wash dishes? Why do you take so long to mop the floor? You know, this company costs money, 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 and you're taking too long to do this and this and that. And I just had a gut full of it. But when I became a writer, I kind of developed a routine. Like when every summer, my wife and I would go down to South Mississippi. We couldn't do it this year because of the epidemic. But what we did, you know, I would take her down to, you know, Purvis, Mississippi, you know, Bass Academy, just outside of Hattiesburg. And I would let her do her thing. She would go to her classes and seminars and Bible studies and what have you. And I would just get in my car and I would just drive around the little communities of South Mississippi. You know, it's a very hot area that we would call the Pine Belt. And, I would verbally stop at you know, one library in one county, and I says, look, I'd like to do a book signing for your library. Would that be all right? And he says, well, we don't do book signings. We don't know how to do book signings or something. I says, okay, thank you, you know, and I'll just get to my car, drive 40 miles down to the next county, and go there. And I went to this one library, and I said, look, I would like to do a book signing here. Would that be all right with y'all? And she said, well, we really can't do a book signing unless we get the approval of our main branch. And I said, okay, let's put your main branch on the phone. Give them a phone call, and I'll talk to them. So she called them, and I said, look, my name is Glenn Stripling, and I'm at this library here, and we need to know if I'm allowed to do a book signing at this particular library. And they would tell me, Well, of course you can do a book signing at a library. What do we care? What are you calling us for? And so I would tell a lady, I would say, yeah, they said we can. And sometimes that's how we would set it up. You know, sometimes they would be a little more cold shoulder. I went to this one town, and I walked in, and, of course, it was summertime. And I said, look, I'd like to do a book signing at this library. I'm an author. And she says, well, we let the Friends of the Library handle that. And I said, okay, can I talk with can you give me the number to your Friends of the Library person? I'll talk with them about it. And she says, well, she's on vacation. We don't give out that information. And I says, well, I'll tell you what, I'm sorry I bothered you. And I'm just, you know, walking out. I just went on to the next town. So, you know, when people frustrate me, whatever, and I'm not getting anywhere with them, you know, it's no ulcer to me. It's no pain. I just go on and do business with somebody else.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you have to do. You can't let people and things keep you down.
Yeah, exactly. I was, you know, I'm not making a lot of money doing this, but at the same time, I'm getting a lot less stress in my life.
There you
which I think is a plus there.
Well, and the thing is, some of the things that you have done in your life and some of the incidents that have happened in your life, you have actually put those into a story. And the one that comes to mind, well, actually there's three. One of the ones that comes to mind was the first story that you did with nudity. I read the backstory on that, and I thought I was going to fall out on the floor.
Oh, yeah, I've actually heard from that's called Tabitha's record. I actually saw a copy of that. I went down up to Carthage, Mississippi, to a book to a flea market up there, and I sold a copy. And I told Tabitha about that, and she wrote me back, and she told me, "Well, that was a very painful memory to her that day." And I said, "Well, I hope I didn't add to her pain."
But you actually dropped a pot of hot beans on you getting in a car. Is that correct?
Yes. You know, at that time, when my wife and I were in Bible study camp that year, I think that was like in 2011. So I burned up my car, and I had to leave it and down in Hattiesburg and drive up. So I spent the entire summer without an automobile. I had to walk to everything where I went to. But, you know, that particular day, Tabitha was giving us a ride down to South Mississippi to see Vernon and Cindy Minton, you know, Vernon, the guy being on your show.
Right.
And I had a Dutch oven with all that soup on me, and I spilled it on my lap. And I had to rip off all my clothes and run into my carport in the nude. And Tabitha was there, and I told my wife to spray me down with water. And she did, and I ran into the bathroom, and I filled up with water and, you know, put cold water. And Tabitha looked so cute, and she came into my house with a clipboard next to her head because she didn't want to see me, but I was wearing a bathrobe at the time. And Kathy put mustard all over my legs because it had what turned out to be second-degree burns on my legs because she's a nurse, and she knows about naturalistic ways of healing, and she knew that mustard has turmeric in it, which is a very good burn treatment. So we got in Tabitha's truck, and she drove me to an ER, and, of course, my I was in so much pain, I told Tabitha to stop because I had a throw up, and I threw up in the middle of the highway, and she drove me all the way, and I stopped. We went to the ER, and this lady says, "Okay, please fill out these forms for us." And I says, "I'm burning in death. I'm in agony." You know, but fate was on my side, I guess. This lady came out, and she recognized my wife, and she says, "Kathy, how you doing?" And of course, my wife is a nurse, and just happened to be a woman that my wife used to work with. And we told her that I was burned and I was in agony. And she says, "Quinn, come in here. Come on in here." So I followed in here, and they took me in, and they found me a doctor, and they gave me a shot of morphine. And then,
but the fact is you were able to use that story, that incident in your life, you were able to wrap it into a story. So something good came out of it after all.
Yes, it did. I was kind of amazed. And it took me about 5 years to pitch it, you know. I would write and I'd send it off, and then I forgot about it for about 2 or 3 or 4 years. And then, you know, out of a whim, I contacted, you know, this guy. And I says, "Look, a few years ago, I wrote a story about me and this lady in this Garden of Eden paradise. And would you be interested in that?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, and he finally accepted it. And then at the time, there was this online magazine called the National Examiner. You know, they deal with UFOs and all kinds of crazy assassination theories and conspiracies and what have you. And I knew the lady, and I told her the story about it. She did a story about me, and I mentioned my incident with Tabitha. And she put that thing in her initial rough draft of the article. And I told my wife about it. I says, "Look, I wrote a story about Tabitha, and this lady is going to tell the whole damn world about it." Sorry, I didn't mean to cuss on the radio. So my wife called Tabitha, and she says, you know, and she told her what happened. And then I wrote a story about it, and she says, "Oh, I don't care if he calls me Tabitha. I don't, you know," see, I disguised her. She does not look like the lady that I have in the story.
Right.
And Tabitha says, "Well, I don't care. I am honored."
See,
and then a few
years. Worked out.
Yeah, it worked out. And then about a year or two later, Tabitha and I sat on this thing about naturalistic healing. And we were talking about turmeric, and Tabitha raises her hand, and she says, "This man here got turmeric, got mustard on his legs when he got burned, and it really helped him." And I got to think, you know, when they took me to the burn doctor before I had skin graft surgery, and she I told the doctor, my wife put this mustard on me when I got burned, and the doctor didn't know what she was doing. He says, "What were you? Was she trying to make a hot dog out of you?" Even the doctor did not know that, you know, turmeric was a good, you know, healing thing.
Most physicians don't. Most people in the medical field are trained to look at the pharmaceutical companies and not to even look at holistic healing. That's why some of this stuff was created by God, was for healing.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, I have I don't have a whole lot of faith in holistic medicine, to tell you the truth. You know, having said that, I used to date a lady that is in holistic medicine, and I have a little bit of faith in it because, you know, when I had a crick on my neck, you know, she would use her yoga powers or whatever to ease my pain or whatever. So I think there's something to it. My main thing, to be honest, is I have more faith, you know, in just faith-based science-based medicine.
Well, we could talk about that all day because I have absolutely no faith in science because it is always evolving and it is always changing.
Well, you probably do more than you realize, Miss Yvonne. I mean, you do go to a doctor, don't you?
No.
If you broke a leg or if
I will
you
put
had
it to
some,
you this way. I was on death's door, literally on death's door before my friends talked me into going to a doctor. I have been fighting with doctors for 65 years, 67 years, because that's why it's called a practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a guessing game. Well, if we think this is wrong, so we're going to run this test to rule this out. Well, if you think this is wrong, why are you running another test to rule something else out? Doesn't make any difference. Doesn't make any sense. It's not logical to me. Well, we think maybe you have A, B, or C, but we're going to run D to rule that out first. Well, if you think I got this, why don't you run this test first?
Having said that, I think you have a good point. When my father died, I'm out here in Lake Norman. I'm in my house here, and I called 911, and I just asked the question, you know, should I continue getting CPR to him, or should I just let him go? And then about 20 minutes later, we had an ambulance. We had police cars. We had the county coroner. We had about 20 people walking around my house asking us if we want to revive him, whatever. And then one of the ladies, some of my brother, you know, their main interest is, you know, to cover their butts.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
exactly. You are
so,
exactly,
you know,
right.
They don't want, their interest is not so much on the law, on the patient, but to protect themselves from the lawsuit. They,
you are exactly right.
Yeah, they're conditioned by society, by this legal system, litigious system that we live in, to always
protect themselves.
Yeah, more than necessary, to, you know, to protect themselves, and I don't blame them, you know, because when you see these tourists coming over from England or France, whatever, coming to America, guess what they take pictures of? Not the Statue of Liberty or the Empire State Building. They take pictures of these coffee cups from McDonald's that says, "Do not, you know, this is very hot. Do not spill on you."
Oh my word!
And yeah,
but so
I mean,
if they spill it, then they have a lawsuit.
Yeah, right. And
caution, hot.
Yeah,
do not spill. Yeah, we'll burn you. Well, anybody that orders coffee, that orders a hot coffee, should have sense enough to know that thing's hot, and if you spill it, it's going to burn you.
Exactly. I was listening to Dr. Laura one day, and one of my favorite stories that she told was this Scandinavian guy was in a lawnmower repair shop or something like that, and this one guy asked him, says, "Let me ask you something. How come, you know, in your country, in Scandinavia, they don't have a warning or user manuals or warning things for, you know, power tools?" And he says, "Well, because no self-respecting Scandinavian would cut his finger off with a power tool and file a lawsuit about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We in America are lawsuit happy. But you're not going to believe this, my friend, and we didn't get half of what I wanted to talk about, so we'll have to bring you back someday. We are down to the last 4 minutes of this show.
Oh, my goodness. Are we time traveling?
And this is the guy that was nervous, ladies and gentlemen, because he was afraid that, I don't know what he was afraid of, but he was nervous. But as anybody that has ever been on this show knows that this hour goes by so, so fast. So what I need for you to quickly do is tell the people where you can be found, and I'm going to give a list of the books for them to go and check you out.
Okay, the best way to find me is go to my Facebook wall. I call it a wall, but other people call it a timeline. It's Glenn Stripling. And if you want to learn a little bit more about me, go to www.credosha.com. And if you want to email me, email at gstrip2002@yahoo.com.
And his books are, his writings are in Shelter of Daylight. His book is Chronasia. He's also in a short story book called Tis the Season. Yours truly is in there as well. I had forgotten all about that story. And then The Song of Jupiter. And I guarantee you, if you like sci-fi and you like things that are different, you will like Glenn's work because he is very informed, he is very articulate, and he is very dedicated to the written word. So check him out, and I always leave my listeners guessing because there are a couple of the stories, like 5 or 6 or 7, and the Beth Israel story that we did not get to. So, Glenn, we have to bring you back so you can talk about those.
Okay, that'd be fine.
So are you going to be doing any book signings real quick?
Well, this COVID-19 thing makes it very difficult. By this time of the year, on a usual year, I would have had about 3 or 5 or 7 book signings already, but I just did my first one yesterday, which is not really a book signing. It was just a flea market kind of thing. I'm negotiating with a museum here in Jackson, hoping they would let me do a book signing. Take part in their event on July the 11th.
Well, everybody listen to that and go join his page, and that way you can keep up with what he's getting ready to do because he's all over the map in Mississippi. He knows Mississippi like the back of his hand, and I'm sure he has some more stories to tell that we have not even gotten to. And when he talks about Natchez Trace, there's a town on the in Lower Mississippi. It's called Natchez Under the River. Natchez Under the, what's it called? Natchez Under the Trace.
Yeah, the Natchez Trace is a highway. It's the oldest highway in Mississippi. It's like 300 years old. Natchez, I think, don't quote me, I think used to be the capital of Mississippi. It was like the Beverly Hills of Mississippi in the 18th century. It's like where the really rich slaveholding entrepreneurs would go. It was the place you would go if you wanted to be really rich back then.
So, see, he can regale us with the history of Mississippi. Now, as of right now, I have no more shows. Because, again, I thought I was going to be traveling. But since I'm not, I will work on getting some shows up. Glenn, I want to thank you, my friend, for allowing me to spend this hour with you.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, we will have to do it again because the hour went by so fast. I mean, it just flew by. It was there and it was gone.
Okay, yeah. And I have you know, some friends that I talk with who on and off want to be on your show too. So
okay.
I was really happy to learn that you brought it back, and I really hope that you continue it. I know you have other responsibilities and what have you, but I really hope you continue this. I think it's a good thing, and I really appreciate all that you do for artists and writers.
Well, thank you. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we will say good night, and we will see you next time around. Good night, my dear.
Good night.
Talk to you soon. And get those people
okay.
to me. All right.
Okay,
bye-bye.
I sure will.